Over 750 secret documents on detainees who have been held at the U.S. prison facility at Guantanamo Bay, Cuba, were released this week. They provide an unprecedented amount of information about who these men are and how U.S. detention policies have worked since 9/11. And we're joined now by McClatchy reporter Carol Rosenberg. She's been following Guantanamo for some time, and we have linked to her extensive coverage in the Miami Herald on our show page at WNYC.org. Carol, welcome back to our show for today's Backstory segment.
Thanks for inviting me.
Now, you've covered Guantanamo for quite some time now. Did any one thing contained in these new documents come as much a surprise to you?
I'd heard a lot about the documents before I'd seen them because they'd been obtained by my organization about a month ago before they had been made public under an embargoed arrangement. But when I finally got a hold of them, it was the pictures that stood out. Many of these files, which are 2 to 12-page risk assessments of each man at Guantanamo who's there or since been released, have photos, mugging photos, mugshots, booking photos, like you'd see in Law and Order. And for 10 years, we've been able to see these men at the detention center, but their pictures have been never allowed to leave the base. The military censors the reporters and photographers down there and destroys any picture that shows what a detainee actually looks like head on. And those pictures were pretty dramatic.
Now, why would they prevent us from seeing the pictures? Because in some cases, these people are so young. I mentioned men, but some of these detainees were swept up when they were boys as young as 14.
Actually, we don't get pictures of the what they call the juvenile enemy combatants or the kids who were there, the boys who were there at the beginning. What these documents are is an evolution of how they kept track of the prisoners, the detainees at Guantanamo. So the early days when they were just overwhelmed with Pakistanis and Afghanis and hundreds of people who've since been released, the paperwork's very thin, and the arguments by which they got them there or explanations that brought them there and the reasons for letting them go are likewise thin. So you don't actually have pictures of the kids, which is unfortunate because it would be interesting to look at them. But you have pictures of most of the people who are there now. And the U.S. has always said you can't show their pictures in public because of their Geneva Conventions protections, that they're giving them some of the protections of war prisoners down at Guantanamo as they hold them in this new kind of war on terror detention arrangement.
But you say Geneva Convention protections, but isn't it, don't some of these documents reveal that these people, some of them have been waterboarded and led around on a leash like a dog, which is something I thought only happened with Lindy England at Abu Ghraib?
Well, as for waterboarding, I don't think you find that in the documents. I think that the only three cases of waterboarding that's ever been proven publicly took place at what were called CIA black sites overseas.
Mm-hmm.
So, in fact, those men who got to Guantanamo had been waterboarded elsewhere, and there's three of them there. As for the dog and the leash, yep, that came up. That was done both at Guantanamo and in the black sites. That's not included in these documents. These documents are the Americans' best case or the Pentagon's best case for why these people deserve to be at Guantanamo. So they're tilted. They're slanted. They are making an argument to the Pentagon and others in the interagency why they're too risky to let go or why what the military intelligence, as they're learning about al-Qaeda and the Taliban, has concluded about these men in the cages who they really didn't know when they got there on these airplanes. So you don't see a lot of the stuff that's come out elsewhere about bad treatment, harsh treatment. There's one sort of reference to a man who's since been released having confessed to some activities, quote, under extreme duress while in the custody of Egypt. And in that instance, a military analyst writing the document on this man who's now home in Australia is being skeptical, actually, or distinguishing between information he gave at Gitmo and information he gave in Egypt. One of the things that the documents also doesn't tell you that we're putting together now and we'll be reporting is how many of these people didn't go straight from Afghanistan to Guantanamo for interrogation, but they ended up other places. You know, the confessed 9/11 mastermind, Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, gets captured 3-4 years before he ever comes to Guantanamo, and he's brought there for trial. So his document is one of the thinnest and least satisfying because, in fact, the people at Guantanamo are writing a risk assessment on a man they've never interrogated because he was in custody of the CIA and brought to Guantanamo for trial. So you don't learn as much about him as you do about, I guess, what you'd call the ordinary captives, the people in the orange jumpsuits that you imagine if you think back to the beginning days of Guantanamo.
Do you know where he was kept after he was captured?
I don't know. I mean, there have been reports that some of these men were in Poland. There's been reports that some of these men were in Thailand. But, you know, the CIA keeps these former captives in a secret camp on Guantanamo so they can't talk to anyone and tell anyone who might be able to tell the public where they were held. I don't know where. We may learn at trial, but we don't know. It was called a black site, and it was a secret CIA prison overseas somewhere.
It's been suggested that in some cases these documents just show what interrogators wanted to believe about detainees.
Well, what they're doing is what they call a mosaic, and this is the theory of intelligence that's gone on at Guantanamo for a number of years. They take pictures of Facebooks, like Facebook pictures, and they go around to different prisoners, and they say, who is this guy? And if a couple of them say, hey, I think I saw him at a training camp, or I think I went to the Al-Qaeda training camp with him back in whatever year, that becomes part of his file. And as the narrative is told, he trained with Al-Qaeda. Whether or not that person in one instance fingered more than 100 guys as having been with him at various places where bad things happen, or he's only fingered by one person who, it turns out, wasn't there anyways, these end up in the files. And so you really have to deconstruct the mosaic, or as I say, add what else we know from other files to their mosaic to figure out where the truth is in these reports, some of which are very old. And by the way, all of which were created during the Bush administration when Obama came in with the intention of closing Guantanamo. They did this process all over again. Those files are still secret. And what we do know is that half of the 172 men at Guantanamo today are cleared for release by the Obama administration. And those half of those men, if you look at these documents, they look pretty bad back then as well. It's hard to distinguish back in the Bush days when they're analyzing who's at Guantanamo between the people who would in the future be released under Obama and the people who would be kept, if that makes sense.
If, in part, these are very dependent on camp snitches repeating what they've heard from fellow captives, are we just relying on a big game of telephone?
To a certain degree, that's what went on. You have to remember that, like I said, the day after September 11th, America woke up and didn't know a lot about Al-Qaeda and the Taliban. And so what happens at Guantanamo is they're really relying on other captives to tell us who's who, how Al-Qaeda worked, what was a training camp. And so, I mean,
and they're using eight detainees' allegations and observations to help build cases against 255 men at Guantanamo.
I believe it was eight different informants showed up in the cases of these 255 men. But yeah, I mean, the idea is that there was a small unit of people or a small group of people who were certainly currying favor with the interrogators by telling them lots and lots of things about the other guys dressed just like them, and that it's not clear that they used any kind of rigor to assess at times how valuable those identifications were. But we do know that many, many of those people who were identified by this one man or that one man are gone. They've been repatriated or resettled, as have the snitches, by the way, who've, in a couple of instances, gotten nice resettlement plans in Europe.
There was an NPR report this morning about how judges and security analysts arrive at startlingly different conclusions on the threat posed by detainees, mm-hmm. often when they're looking at the exact same evidence.
That's correct.
So what's happening there? Are people asking different kinds of questions?
What's happening there is military intelligence is not a law enforcement or legal measure. They are gathering tidbits and writing documents that would never stand up in a court of law because there's no chain of evidence, and these are not law enforcement officers deciding that when this man fingers that man, this is credible evidence. So what happens is these whole fact patterns and allegations end up, now that we have habeas corpus challenge, at the federal court in Washington. And we know that there has been time and again where a federal judge has looked at the equivalent of these files that leaked through WikiLeaks and said, doesn't work. This is not evidence. Or, in some cases, what you purport to be evidence was clearly the fruit of coercion or torture, or clearly the fruit of some other foreign interrogation agency providing information that is not reliable in American court. And I say, let this man go.
Hasn't it also been revealed that Chinese and Russian interrogators were allowed to speak with the detainees?
Yeah, that was interesting. When, you know, you read through the documents, one of the things you learn about is how Guantanamo worked back in the early days. And the defense lawyers have been telling us for years that they let the Chinese and Russian interrogators into the camps. And the military has never confirmed it, but there they are in the documents. I mean, there's a number of issues like that. One thing that jumped off the page to me is that I go there all the time, and they have made it a part of their talking points that nobody involuntarily goes to interrogation, that interrogations are voluntary. In fact, they call them reservations, and they characterize them as kind of pleasant. Well, in one detainee's file, one prisoner's file down there, they as part of the consideration of his risk, they say he twice had to be forcibly extracted to go to his reservation. And what that basically is telling us is that people didn't have the option to decline an interrogation. They got an appointment, and they were taken there if they didn't. So that was pretty interesting.
According to the UK's Guardian, the documents show that interrogators at Guantanamo Bay were told to rank links to Pakistan's intelligence service alongside al-Qaeda, Hamas, and Hezbollah as an indication of terrorist or insurgent activity. But isn't the ISA supposed to be one of our allies in the region?
Well, I think that sort of reflects the nature of making it up as you go along. The intelligence down there was trying to figure out data points and links that would be something that would be suspicious or you know, why would, say, an Arab from the Arabian Peninsula be talking to Pakistani intelligence. And, yeah, it looked pretty embarrassing. I understand that there was a pretty angry reaction to that report.
The documents also suggest that ownership of a Casio F91W model watch is a sign that a detainee may have received al-Qaeda training in IED bomb making. That's a pretty common mass-produced watch.
Yeah, that we've known for years, that people found with Casio watches on their wrists or in their bags were particularly suspect because there was supposedly I can't remember if it was a manual or somebody told them in interrogation that al-Qaeda had figured out how to turn a specific model of watch into a detonator.
Yeah, well, one of my staff has that watch, and I wonder whether I should be turning him in.
Yeah, well, if he were taken to Guantanamo back in 2002 wearing that watch, that would have been a data point on his file.
I hope you're listening, Stephen. Several news organizations in this country have touched on the fact that Sami Al-Haj, an Al Jazeera cameraman, was also held at Guantanamo for a number of years. Why was he kept there? Were they suggesting that he was a terrorist?
Well, that's sort of what we characterized at McClatchy as we were studying these papers as mission creep. You know, the original intent was to find out where Osama bin Laden was, to learn about any sleeper cells, other groups of hijackers like the men who took the planes over on September 11th, and to help with finding the leaders of the Taliban. But what we discovered was mission creep, that once the military intelligence and interrogators got these foreign men, mostly these Arabs, they came up with other ideas for information they could learn from them that was not within necessarily the stated mission. Sami al-Hajj, I believe they wanted to learn more about Al Jazeera. There was a man who got sent there because they singularly only sent there because they wanted to learn more about Bahraini personalities in the royal court. He was from Bahrain. There were people who were scooped up along the Pakistan-Afghanistan border who they knew when they put them on the planes were not Al-Qaeda and were not the Taliban, but they knew the routes. They knew they were like they could be like scouts and know the footpaths out of the Tora Bora Mountains into Pakistan. And they bring them to Guantanamo because it seems that the interrogators needed to learn more about escape routes. But when they leave, these reports indicate that they got nothing of value out of them. And all I could think of is the sharecropper they picked up along the border, maybe he wasn't a map reader, and certainly put him 8,000 miles away in Guantanamo, and he's not necessarily able to help or willing to help American interrogators learn about the footpaths out of the Tora Bora Mountains. So that's all the mission creep aspect of it. They seem to have maybe at times lost their focus or tried to figure out other things. There was one fellow there, he's now in Europe, who they had sent to Guantanamo because he'd been in the Uzbek military and they thought they'd learned something about the presidential guard in Uzbekistan. That's like nowhere on any briefing I've ever seen about why Guantanamo was created.
Well, how many times can you ask the same question over 10 years? So the remaining 172 prisoners at Guantanamo have been designated high risk, but weren't many of the prisoners who were released also designated high risk at some point during their stay?
Absolutely. I mean, there were some who were, and these are to us some of the most interesting ones, no value, no intelligent value, no risk, and let go early. Some of which, you know, they have argued, probably correctly, have gone on to be pretty angry at the Americans and engage in attacks on the soldiers. So we haven't yet done a scientific study of how many high-risk and high-value captives left and got in trouble with the Americans again, frankly.
In its coverage of these documents, the New York Times said Guantanamo looks more and more like an enduring American institution. Do you think it is?
Well, yes, but it's not the documents that cause it to be so. It's that Congress has decided that they're not going to give the president the tools to close it. The documents actually make an argument they echo the argument of Congress that they've got the right people down there and they are America's enemies and that's the right place for them. But it's really the policy of the president and the Congress of keeping Guantanamo intact at this stage and having military trials down there. And, you know, it's this president who decided that they would hold, at this point, 47 people as indefinite detainees without ever trial or charge. So I don't know if it's the documents that are persuasive, but it does look like it's fairly enduring, yes.
You were just awarded the Robert F. Kennedy Journalism Award for your coverage of Guantanamo.
Yes, thank you.
Congratulations.
Thank you very much.
And thank you so much for being with us again, Carol Rosenberg, whose articles on the WikiLeaks secret documents that were just released are in the Miami Herald. She works for McClatchy. And you can locate them on our show page at WMIC.org, where we have a link. Thank you so much for being with us, Carol. I'm sure we'll be speaking to you again, as long as there's such a thing as indefinite detention.
Without charge. Thank you very much.